So, just settling back into a comfortable posture. Can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And bringing the attention into the body. Just feel the sensations of sitting, the sensation of stillness. Seeing that even when the body is still, the activities of life continue. The breath, the heart, the nervous system, the senses all alive. And so we take a kind of observational stance, just observing the experience of being alive in this very fundamental level, this simple experience of breath and heart and nervous system, sensations, sounds, thoughts and feelings. And letting the body soften, settle, and then seeing if there's a feeling of calm or a feeling of edginess or agitation, if there's some mood present, like a peaceful or happy, sad, anxious, or just more neutral. When we first try to become aware of feelings, of mood and emotions, it can seem somewhat alien. It can be difficult to pinpoint. We might ask, what am I looking for? Are these feelings usually have some element in the body, something felt in the body, but it's not exactly a physical experience. There's more subtlety to it, a mental, but not exactly thoughts. So it does take time to learn how to know what we're feeling, even though we know. That is, we can say what we're feeling, but we might not be able to find it, find where the feeling that we identify resides. This is the subtle realm of meditation. Because we start to see that the felt experiences conditioning the thoughts, and that thoughts are conditioning the feelings. The feeling realm is deeply conditioned. The Buddha calls this underlying tendencies. So these moods and emotions and feelings become very familiar. We start to identify with them. Not seeing that they are actually constructions. Anything that is constructed, anything that is born, must also deconstruct at some point. So feelings are impermanent. They are unsatisfactory. And perhaps most important, they are not self. They are not who you are. When working with feelings, it's important to stay connected to the breath, to the body. Otherwise, we can get lost in the feelings and then the stories that arise. So coming back to the breath, as always, is our really a refuge. As the mind starts to settle, becomes what the Buddha calls malleable and wieldy. And at times it can be possible to actually cultivate positive feelings, positive states. This is the practice of loving kindness. The Buddha says, radiating kindness over the entire world. We can translate that in our meditation into a radiating kindness or warmth through our entire body, which is, in some sense, our entire world as living beings. So that certain degree of calm allows this more intentionality to be applied to the felt experience. It's not exactly controlling how we feel, but we can call it inclining the mind toward certain states. Thank you. So here's a small like tidbit of meditation. It's not etiquette exactly, but it's sort of like, it's like, don't move as soon as they hear the bell. Wait for a moment, breathe and listen to the bell. And instead of thinking of the bell as, oh, now it's over, think of the bell as sound. Let me listen to sound and be present with that. And then that kind of allows you to then move gently out of your space of meditation. So that was sort of an accidental guided meditation, as so many of mine are. But I feel like I need to talk a little bit about what was happening there. You know, working with feelings, and by feelings, I essentially mean emotions, but that's such a vague term, and has a lot of, it has a lot of dimensions to it. I guess the main distinction I'd make is that there are, like, I guess I think of them as primary emotions, where like you're kind of triggered, something strong comes up, anger, grief, anxiety, on joy. I remember the good ones, you know. And it's something that just, you're kind of like, oh, that just, you feel great in that moment. And then there's the more like background or lingering ones, which is kind of what I was talking more about when I was talking about, you know, that we're very deeply conditioned. And that, so my sense is that each of us has sort of emotional themes that we tend to move through and tend to kind of get drawn into, maybe. Or that tend to arise for us. And, you know, they, particularly if some of them are difficult ones, you know, that becomes a problem. But they, you know, we come to really identify with them, so that we really see ourselves as being a person who feels like this. That's kind of, you know, and that's, you know, that's great if you're somebody who feels happy a lot of the time, like some people do. I don't understand them, but, you know, there's that natural capacity, the kind of the set point they talk about. But, you know, there's the tendencies to fall into negative states, then of course the identification then becomes a kind of doubling down on the experience. Like, that's, not only do I feel this, but this is who I am. And you know, there can be an implicit self-judgment, because if I feel bad, then I am bad in some way, you know, that even if we're not literally thinking that, there, we can kind of carry that, and it does put us, I know for myself, because I'm talking about myself and that here to a great extent, that you know, there's a sense of being out of step with the world, like you're supposed to be happy, you know, and if you're not, then there's something sort of wrong with you. And indeed, you know, in the therapeutic world, painful emotions get diagnosed as a pathology. Pleasant emotions don't get diagnosed as a pathology. They're just, so, which means that's, you're supposed to feel good. We don't have to think about that. But if you feel bad, there's something wrong with you. And we need to, it needs to be fixed and treated. And, you know, we've got a drug for that, or a therapy for that, or a meditation for that. You know? So to me, like, the coming into a relationship of essentially acceptance and kindness towards your own difficult feelings is really important. Because when we have a difficult feeling and then we've got this like label hanging over our head of what's wrong with us, then we start to think about how there's something wrong with us, and that makes you feel worse. And that then the cycle just gets perpetuated. So I have to do bring a lot of compassion. You know, seeing what happened to Naomi Osaka this weekend, really, like, if you weren't paying attention to the tennis player who withdrew from the French Open because she had too much anxiety about speaking in front of the press. And I was like, yeah, please. And anyway, I saw a lot of like stupid negative comments about it. I must have been looking at the wrong social media feed. So to continue, I took the guided meditation somewhere else then, which is which is also really important and helpful with meditation in general, but it is particularly interesting around difficult feelings, which is that, as I said, when the mind becomes quieter, the Buddha has this term, these terms, malleable and wieldy. So the word wieldy is one I don't remember ever encountering before the suttas, but then I realized, oh, it's the opposite of unwieldy. And something that's unwieldy is something that's unmanageable. Like you think of trying to, like, you know, carry a mattress alone or something. It's unwieldy. But something that's wieldy is like something you can easily manipulate and control. And malleable, of course, is like, think about like, what's this stuff, the putty, silly putty, you know, like that's like malleable, right? You squeeze. So the Buddha says, like, when your mind gets really quiet, you can actually shape it and you can actually move it into certain mind states, into mind states, if you set your intention to do that. Now, this is of course a very risky idea because it can trigger the impulse to control and to want things. Oh, let me get my mind quiet so that I can make it feel like this. You know, and that's a surefire way for that not to happen, because there's a grasping there. So we have to be really careful that we're not grasping in this state. But if the mind gets quiet, the only way the mind gets quiet is if there's not grasping. So you know, if you work at your not grasping for a while, it gets quiet, and then it's a little tricky to explain how to move the mind into the positive states. But the metta practice is a good example of it. If you've ever done loving kindness practice, and not just the verbal part of it, but the radiating kindness part of it, the kind of sense of like an expansiveness, almost like your mind is bigger than your head, bigger than your body. It's spacious. So you start to actually learn how to, you know, manipulate in a positive way these mind states. A better term is cultivate rather than manipulate, because it has less of an idea of controlling and more of an idea of planting a seed and allowing nature to take its course, which is essentially what we do in this kind of practice, this cultivating practice. But it's very interesting. I was working with this over the weekend because I was struggling with some feelings and just sitting and letting and getting quiet enough and then radiating. And really, it's this really cleansing feeling. There's a sense of and it does feel almost chemical in the body, but there's a sense of kind of cleaning out all those heavy feelings. And it's not a cure, and it doesn't make them go away permanently, but it can kind of raise the mood and lift the mood out of that difficult space, at least temporarily, which is everything is temporary, so why not? So I don't know if all of that is helpful or if it's too vague or I don't know. I it's not what I was planning and still planning to talk about something else on the steps this morning, but I felt like the when I fell into that guided meditation, I needed to talk about it a little bit. So having said all that, I want to actually open it up for any questions about what I'm saying so that maybe you can help me to be more clear. Or maybe there's some things that can clarify. Yeah, Anne, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
It's good to be here. I was away last week. Good to be here.
Yeah.
I just finished doing, when you were speaking of the radiation, radiating. First I thought that for me, when my mind gets quiet and the grasping is at a minimum or none for a little bit, the Brahma Viharas or the loving kindness piece sort of spontaneously happens often. And so then my practice becomes more concentrated on that. And then I'll kind of go back and forth. I think what helps me a lot and has increased this sense of this, how do I feel spacious or warm to radiating, is my mindful movement practice. And I just spent an hour doing that.
Yeah.
And so I feel that when I'm moving mindfully and I'm bringing breath, intention, awareness to those qualities, that I really get a felt sense of what it feels like to be spacious and light, feel light and warm and joy, yeah. Actually. So it's helpful just to add that. Peace.
I think that chi is very much part of this equation, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, since it's just as sort of vague an idea as radiating kindness, it sort of, you know, all of these things are just ways of trying to put words on non-material.
Formless energy.
Formless energies, yes.
Yeah.
That are so what doesn't have form is very difficult to name. It doesn't, basically, if it has no form, it has no name. It's like nama rupa in the Buddhist tradition is name and form go together. And so if there is no form, there probably is no name.
Right.
It's a good little whatever.
I like that. Yeah.
Thank you.
It's all good.
I think you're definitely, that's another really helpful guidance about moving it, because it is what we're talking about is moving energy. So there's like an internal moving of energy, just an emotional moving of energy. But I mean, it's why they recommend, like, you know, exercise, just like, you know, aerobic exercise for depression. It's a more simple way. Someone is, can you recommend where to find more info about mindful movements? Andy, you want to respond to that?
There's so many. I can have a conversation with you after at some point, but like what you're specifically looking for, be happy to. I have a lot of.
And that's, I will say that, Greg Pergament, who is sort of part of this community, has a book called Qigong in Recovery.
Oh, I've been reading it lately too. Again, it's great. Yeah, it's really well I don't think anyone else has written a book about Qigong and recovery. So
no, I don't think so.
It's very good.
Yeah, and Greg
teaches on Thursday mornings at 10.
Yeah,
Pacific.
And I don't have that link for that. Maybe Angela can dig that up in her in her vast Googling skills.
I try to make it as much as I can. I have it just on hand. It's in my calendar. Okay, I highly recommend Greg's Qigong class. Yeah.
Can you put a link to that?
I will, absolutely.
Yeah, great. Okay.
I'm going to get an online class going here sometime soon.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah.
Yay me.
Yeah, you. all right. Well, shall I move on to the theme of the day in the promises? We're in step nine. We're taking this side trip. For those who haven't been with us, I've been working my book One Breath at a Time. For the last year and months, and we were in step nine, and so in the what's called the promises, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we'll be amazed before we are halfway through. This is from the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We've covered those in previous classes. Now, the next one is we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. So I am going to read from my book, Buddhism and the 12 Steps Daily Reflections, from September 13th, called Knowing Peace. The Buddha said that the highest form of happiness is peace. For addicts, this takes some time to understand. We sought something more wild, frenzied, and blissful. We wanted peak experiences and rapturous pleasure. Peace seemed a little too flat. As we become more mindful and gain more clarity in recovery, we discover the underlying discomfort of that frenzy. It always contained a bit of fear, in a sense that it was never enough. We were constantly chasing something, always looking for more, more, more. When we finally landed in recovery, it might have seemed a little boring at first, but that was because our awareness wasn't subtle enough to appreciate peace and serenity. With time, however, our awareness grew until excitement and thrills began to lose their allure, and quiet, stillness, and calm drew us in. Now we aren't chasing so many things. We aren't on the prowl for thrills and chills. We discover that life as it is, simple and clean, is actually fulfilling. A job well done, a meaningful conversation, a meal shared with friends. These simple pleasures become not just enough, but truly joyful events. The steps have gotten us here, first by confronting our addiction and letting it go, then finding a new way of living in harmony with the Dharma, and finally by honestly reviewing and trying to heal our past. We have arrived at a place where life is no longer so complicated. Sure, we have our problems, but they're no longer insurmountable. Buddhism gives us guidelines for understanding experience. Everything is impermanent. No need to fight with change. There's an unsatisfactory quality to experiences, and that's okay. We don't need perfection. When we lead with love, compassion, and forgiveness, life unfolds without a lot of stress. Today, reflect on the level of peace you have in your life. What could you do to enhance your serenity? Well, so that's that. I've always really liked that line, and I, it, you know, even I guess, early in recovery, but also as I was working on One Breath at a Time, this promise that we would come to, I can't remember the phrase now, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. It always appealed to me, and it had a, you know, it always seemed to have a very direct connection to Buddhism. I think it does take us a while to really appreciate what that means. But it's so interesting when we start to experience real peace in our lives, how we start to shy away from things that might have really drawn us before. You know, when we might have sort of been drawn into drama, and all drama just doesn't seem worth it anymore. And we'll, you know, find ourselves, you know, separating from certain people in our lives, just like, oh no, that's like, you know, that person just wants to stir things up, or obviously certain activities. And that's where I really think that we can see our recovery maturing when we find we're just not drawn to that kind of agitation, or even, as I say, kind of thrill seeking. You know, it just doesn't really mean that much anymore. And when you start to really taste this through meditation, this can have a really profound effect, that where you know, people after going on a retreat or two start to be like, oh, I actually want to go on a longer retreat, you know, I want to do more of that. And I need to meditate longer in the morning, and I need to meditate more often. It's like we get start to be drawn in just the opposite direction of the addict, the kind of thrill seeking addict, to just drawn deeper and deeper towards peace. And that's what leads people to the monastic life. It's like, oh, well, how could I really live this fully? Oh, well, maybe I should just let go of this world entirely and wear, you know, shave the head and put on the robes. It becomes starts to have a really powerful allure, this appreciation of peace that comes. And it is, I think that what I said in that piece, I think is true, that our awareness as addicts isn't subtle enough to appreciate peace. You know, it's our awareness is too gross. It's just like we need something intense to like get our attention or to make us feel anything. You know, we can't, we're so numbed that, you know, we need something really, you know, volcanic to get our attention. And, you know, so there is a process. It takes time. I think also really points to some of the struggles of early recovery, you know, where boredom or just, yeah, not enough going on can be a trigger for relapse. You know, and the feeling that we need more to happen. It takes some time to transition into just enjoying, you know, going to a meeting and sitting there and listening to people talk about their stuff, you know, not really a party, you know. So, well, And there you are for that. Thoughts, comments, peace, serenity. Hello, Carol. Please speak.
Hi, Al. Thanks for the lead this morning. When I was in my addiction, everything needed to be over the top. It had to be fireworks, bright colors, fast cars. And I was always searching for that, you know, and the more I drank, you know, it that goal got further away, you know, and I feel like, you know, the 12 steps got me sober, but the Buddha Dharma Sangha is helping me lead a more peaceful life. And early on, when I was deep in the 12 steps, I learned the long version of the Serenity Prayer, which there's a line in that that says, may I be reasonably happy in this life. And when I started to really think about that concept and try and adopt it into my life, people said, you're giving up. Why do you want just reasonably happy? But I needed that to tame me down. So while I feel like I have a measure of joy every day in that calm, reasonably happy life, there are times that I do feel happiness. I'm above that bar, right. You know, and there are times where I'm below it. And yeah, that's okay. But it's like the yin yang. You can't have one without the other. And neither is going to last forever because of impermanence. So, you know, I started to call it my lame life, and I love my lame life. It's kind of a joke now, you know, because I do have a very vibrant life. And, you know, I like what you said about these monastics, because you look at some of them and they seem like they have no joy at all because they're so monotone. But you know what? That is their joy. Mm-hmm. You know, and my level of joy isn't going to be yours or theirs or whatever. But right now, you know, the promises have come true in my life. I'm in my 11th year of sobriety and, you know, things have never been better. So, and I made that comment in the chat about the second dart, because life would throw things at me and my default was, oh, poor me. You know, it was kind of a good thing to feel worse than everybody else because people would feel sorry for me, you know, and the concept of having my mind being wieldy is that I can change that default, that I don't have to go to the poor me. I don't have to throw the second dart at myself. I can sit with whatever the world throws at me. And then, okay, soon I'll be back at that reasonably happy line. And that's okay. I like reasonably happy. So that, you know, I loved all that you said. It's made me think a lot deeper about those emotions and how I can change my mind when I'm meditating. So thank you for that.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much, Carol. And just really good energy this morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And reasonably happy is perfect. You know, it's just like, you know, that line from my book, Recovering Joy, not unhappy, you know.
Yeah.
Good enough. You know, it's good enough. Yeah, thanks. Myrna, hi. Nice to see you.
Hi there. Good to be here. What you described was my life. And, you know, I was very, suffered anxiety and fear, like, oh, man, and that's what I drank over. And I don't have that today. I've been meditating, you know, for 30 years and really, I mean, I meditate a lot. I'm a big meditator and I know I always think I'm at a place in my life where kids gone, my husband, we're semi-retired and, you know, have a very peaceful, quiet lifestyle. And I practice this way of life though, this mindful way of life. It is my life today. And it brings me a lot of joy. I've never had that before, but it's the awareness, for instance, of just walking from one place to another. Oh, yeah. Mindfully walking, kissing the earth with my feet, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say. Mm-hmm. I mean, just things like that, constant reminders, washing the dishes, mindfully washing the dishes. And that brings a lot of joy in my life. Mindfulness has just transformed my life. Mm-hmm. It's just, and you know, I also go to AA, and, but see, I read your stuff, your daily reflections when I chair a meeting. Uh-huh. And that's my group. They're very open. They love it. You know, they're very open. That's the kind of group that I go to. And I wouldn't be going to that group if they weren't open. So this is like such a gift, Kevin, that you do this, this hour class. It just, I love it. You know, I just totally love it. I just don't want to miss it. So thanks. And thanks everyone for being here. It's awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, Myrna. So nice to see you. Myrna was in the MMTCP teacher training. And I'm looking at the screen here and I see four people who are either currently or previously in that group. So you don't all know each other, but I'm going to name you. Anne, yes, who was in the first cohort, Renato. Mm-hmm. And Paula, who is in the current one. Monica, were you in it? You're oh, okay. You were just saying hi. Okay, cool. I want to get to Desai, because she had her hand up for a while. Nice to see you.
Hi Kevin.
Bonjour.
Bonjour. Merci to all of you for your shares. And you said something really powerful. You said that boredom can be a trigger for relapse at first. And that just blew my mind. I've been on sick leave since April 19th. I'm a kindergarten teacher, and it was just too hard at work. Not enough resources and a lot of suffering kids. So I burnt out. And I'm finding that although I have all this time on my hands and I'm meditating so much, there's this huge anxiety in me. And it feels like all I want is to self-medicate.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I keep hitting myself over the head, like, what's wrong with you, to say you're meditating, you're not working, you should be relaxed, you should be serene. And I'm anything but serene. I'm afraid, my startle reflexes are out, you know, just, and I, you know, I'm realizing that, well, maybe it's this boredom, the huge void of my days used to be planned from 5:30 in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. And now it's empty. Yeah. And instead of that being beautiful and serene, it's anxiety producing. Yeah. So yeah, thanks for that. I feel a little bit more enlightened.
Well, thank you for sharing that too. And I think it's really important what you're talking about. You know, I've had those times too, where it's like, oh, it's great, I've got all this space and time. And like, but it's not necessarily the best thing. I mean, that can happen on retreat too, where you kind of get crazy, you know, because there's nothing happening. And, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, if you go to one of the Thai forest monasteries, they are scheduled throughout the day. They're monks and nuns living, but they're not, it's not like, oh, it's just like a wide open. No, their day, they get up at a certain time, they meet, they chant, then they do cleaning, then they'll have their breakfast, then they'll, you know, every part of the day is scripted in a way. And, you know, so I don't think that having a routine and a schedule is an unspiritual thing, you know, because we associate it in our culture so much with work. Like, oh, well, I want to go on vacation and not be so busy. But, you know, it's like the people that retire and then have a heart attack because it's like there's nothing happening in their life. You know, I think being active And I think that it was, you know, you had that intuition when you heard Anne share about the movement, like, oh, maybe I should be moving my body. Like, you know, I need something to keep the energy moving, right? Because we can really get stuck. And if we have any tendency towards negative mind states, they can really invade into that vacuum. They fill that vacuum, you know? So definitely I would encourage you to, you know, get more active and, you know, start writing, painting, dancing, hiking, carpentry, building, making pottery, something, you know, find it. Do something you love. Yeah. And don't drink or use no matter what, please. Yeah, thank you. All right, one more from Jim. We'll let the guy speak.
One of the smaller percentage today, Kevin.
Yes.
And I'll make this quick. I know we're running out of time.
That's all right.
I just wanted to publicly thank you. You've given me today another take on happiness. I remember you talking just a week or so ago where you said that happiness, you had to take a longer view of it and step back and look at the big picture to realize that you are happy when you think about how much you appreciate your family and mm-hmm. your life, and that all these emotions come and go, but it's all underneath the happiness umbrella. And mm-hmm. That was an awesome context to put all this in a week or so ago, and then you just backed it up today with something else to add to that. And I just wanted to really thank you for that. That was very impactful.
All right. Well, thank you. It was an accident, but you know. So, yeah, I want to mention that, and I didn't say anything about this last week, but I'll say it now because Greg's name came up. Greg Pergament, who is the Qigong teacher. And for those of you who have sat retreats with me, you know him very well. And his stepdaughter died last week of brain cancer. So he's presumably that's why there was no class last week. And I don't know. I've been talking with him, and you can imagine it's really, really rough. She had two small children, and so the family is pretty crushed, and so he's just trying to help everybody get through it. So you know, it's worth checking that link, but if he doesn't show up this week, you'll understand why. But knowing Greg, he probably will start showing up pretty quickly because he knows that it's going to do him as much good as it will everyone else.
Yeah, it was nice, actually. He did. And Julie said because I knew he does Desert Dharma on Monday evenings, which I can also share the details of that. But Amy was she loved the Chinese arts, and he said last week that he was planning on having a dedication to her this week. So okay. I assume, that class will happen. So, and it will be a special one.
for sure. All right. So let's just close with some metta. For all beings, the Buddha says, radiating kindness, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whether they are weak or small, omitting none, the great or the mighty, the born and the unborn, and those who have passed. May we create the circumstances in our life for goodness and for happiness, for peace. May all beings live in harmony, live in love.
Namaste.
Blessings, everyone.
Namaste. Thank you so much.